So Cambridge's once dark reputation as one of Britain's most crime-ridden cities of the 1970s has been revealed. Samantha Greenwood, now 47, was caught up in the violence as a child and has now written a book about her chaotic upbringing. Now, in the process, she's discovered some startling facts about what Cambridge was like back then. So Samantha's joined us in the Cambridge 105 studio. Samantha, hi. Thank you so much for coming in. It's really lovely to have you here. I really appreciate you coming in because this is quite fascinating to me personally, because I grew up in Cambridge, a similar kind of time. I'm only slightly younger than you, and I have quite similar memories, not obviously quite the same. So first of all, let's talk about your history and what life was like for you when you grew up in Cambridge.
Well, I suppose I was growing up in a dysfunctional family where it was kind of the time of the 70s where it was all about free love and kind of the women's revolution, I suppose, was already in full swing. But it wasn't completely like that, especially in my household, although there was the fact that my parents had kind of wife-swapped with people a couple of streets away, another couple. My mum had a really tough time with my dad. He was very abusive towards her. There was lots of domestic violence. And somehow they managed to get entangled with this other couple and eventually swapped. My mum went to move with the other man in question, and the gentleman moved in with this other woman. And I had to go and live with my mum with this new man, and behave as if it was all perfectly normal. And on top of that, there was lots of drug taking involved, alcohol consumption. I had uncles in my family that were involved in burglaries, were always on the wrong side of the law, always getting in and out of trouble. And my memories go back as early as being sort of 4 years old, and can remember sort of strange goings on and things that weren't quite as they should be, and feeling sort of quite an upset child, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine what that must have been like. But you were living in Cambridge City Centre. Are you an only child? I mean, were there any other children around?
No, I have. I've actually got three brothers. One of them is a half-brother that was born much later on. He's 9 years younger than me. But I had two brothers at the time, which were by my dad, and one of them, so I lived with my mum and this new partner. One of my brothers, who is a year younger than me, lived with my dad and his new partner, as a result of the wife swap. Mm-hmm. And my oldest brother, who's 3 years older than me, went to live with my grandparents. Well, he was already living with them. Mm. So you can imagine it was a very kind of splintered family background anyway.
Mm. I mean, it's you mentioned the drug taking. Were you aware of that? I mean, did this go on for years? I mean, did you stay at home? Did you live at home throughout teenage years as well?
Even from that period onwards, even up until I was probably 12, 13, when my mum had remarried much later on, I can remember having uncles coming to the house and they'd set up scales in the dining room and they'd be weighing amphetamines and sulfate in there to distribute, and I can remember them being under the influence of drugs themselves and disappearing for weekends to go to all-nighters and kind of having a party, I suppose.
And obviously as a child, I mean, you know what's going on, you sort of understand, but I mean, it affects you obviously in ways that you can't even probably describe. I mean, did you go to school? Did you manage to live a normal life? Did you have friends, or did you...
We weren't really encouraged. We did have friends, but we weren't encouraged to invite them back to the house. We weren't told to invite people around for dinner. And I think people in the area knew about my family background, and we didn't get invited to other children's houses. They wanted their children to kind of steer clear of us and probably make a better choice of friends, I suppose, that come from nicer backgrounds, I suppose. That's how their parents saw it. And then I had long periods off away from school because my mum was very ill at one point because one of my uncles had drowned, and that was why he was fleeing from a burglary. And then she went into this terrible descent of depression which lasted for months and months, and it meant I ended up having time off school. I mean, one period in particular was a whole sort of 6 month stint of staying away to help look after my mum and my younger brother, who I said is 9 years younger than me. And I was having to try and cook meals. My mum was crawling into my bed in the early hours of the morning because my stepdad was a milkman at that point, and she didn't want to be left on her own because she was afraid. So it was a very difficult time.
Oh my goodness, Samantha. I mean, looking at you now, you're a beautiful woman who's extremely articulate. I mean, you would never imagine that you would have that kind of, you know, upbringing, really. I mean, you've done incredibly well. I mean, you were saying to me that obviously you didn't have many life expectations particularly, but you've managed to somehow rise above it all. I mean, tell us what happened. Obviously, you left school with...
Well, I think it was always, even before leaving school, I knew there was a different way of living. We used to go to my paternal grandparents, even though my real dad had gone to prison. We went to my paternal grandparents every weekend, and we'd spend sort of from Friday evening until Sunday evening with them. And that was very different there because we did normal things. You know, we'd go for walks in the woods and collect leaves to do rubbings of leaves and collect feathers to make kind of Indian hats with. And we'd learn to play rounders and cricket. And, you know, that was kind of, I suppose, my saving grace when I was growing up, that I had that kind of respite every weekend. And I loved it. I loved being at my grandparents'. And that was where I'd be with my brothers. And I suppose as time went on, I had more and more of an awareness that there was this huge comparison between that and my home life and which I preferred. And there was no doubt a bit about which was preferable, what kind of lifestyle I'd like to have.
Mm. So when you left school, what did you do? Did you manage to work or how did you survive?
Well, when I left school, I had no qualifications whatsoever. I was, I say encouraged, but it really wasn't as if I had an option. My mum basically told me that there was a job going where she worked, which was at our local Budgins. And I was kind of pressured, I guess, into just taking a job because that was the most that she could kind of foresee for me. I was led to believe that most women would just get married, get pregnant, and that was as much as I could wish for. So I just took the job, and the start of my working life was shelf filling in our local Budgins.
Mm. And what do you do now, Samantha? Do you work now?
Oh, now I work as a chef at Babram Research Campus. Mm. And I have worked at sort of chef manager level prior to this. Mm. And in my spare time, I've been writing, hence my book.
Yeah, so let's talk about the book. What's the book called?
The book's called Ash on Snow. And I chose that title because the prologue to my book is about a time when I went to school and I dragged a casket of ashes to school in the snow. And the ashes belonged to my mum's lover, which is who my stepdad had killed. And that's why he was in prison for the time that he was. And all of those things are written about in my book.
So, wow, you dragged the ashes to school and you remember doing that. Why did you take the ashes to school?
I was 6 years old and I probably didn't really understand why I was doing it. I just wanted to be liked, I think. Mm. And in my kind of strange idea of being popular, I thought, well, if I take these ashes to school and show all of the other children at show and tell, they'll be absolutely astounded by me and they'll think, wow, this is incredible. Nobody's ever brought something like this before. And my teacher got a big surprise as well because she didn't even ask me what it was I wanted to show and tell. So there I was in a classroom of unsuspecting pupils and teacher, revealing a casket of ashes. Needless to say, my parents got called in to have a talk after that little encounter.
So, well, I mean, let's just rewind a minute. So your father murdered your mum's lover.
Well, this is the basis of my book, really, that the whole sort of wife swapping event that the story is based around. I mean, I say it's the main part of my book, but really it's about the fallout of what actually happens as a consequence of that. My dad has a confrontation with this other man that the whole wife swapping thing has happened with, Richard Gillingham. And
at the house? I mean, do you remember any of this? Did you see it?
My dad apparently was trying to arrange a birthday party, and the other man comes to the house to have a discussion with him, and an argument ensues, and my dad attacks him with a knife that just happens to be... He's apparently washing up, he's at the kitchen sink. One thing leads to another, and it just goes horrifically out of control. And my dad goes to prison. He's sentenced to 10 years for manslaughter. It wasn't premeditated. And I go to visit him with my brothers over the next few years, and, you know, we see him there.
And how was that? I mean, which prison was he in? Was he? Did
he
have
went
to
Wandsworth?
Right.
I write a chapter about that in my book, about what it was like going to visit him and what I witnessed while I was visiting him there. And my granddad used to smuggle money into him, which one of my brothers would go and get a packet of chewing gum from the kind of tuck shop that was there. And my dad would use the foil wrapper from the chewing gum to kind of parcel a little wad of money and swallow, so that he could kind of smuggle it back to his cell and buy whatever it was he was trying to get a hold of while he was confined. And I find it really bizarre looking back now, because my grandparents was really quite upstanding people, and I don't know how he managed to sort of coerce him into even taking part in any of this, but they did, because they loved him so much.
Of course. Yeah. And how did you feel about your dad when he went to prison? Did that change your... I mean, what did you, you know, how did you feel about your parents, really?
I was relieved that my dad went to prison, because I'd always been afraid of him, and I'd witnessed scenes of violence between him and my mum, or him attacking my mum. And I was terrified of him. So when I knew that he was being put behind bars, if you like, for want of a better phrase, I just felt relieved that I knew I'd only see him under supervision in
a safe place.
In a safe place. Mm. And it just made, you know, my mum seemed happier, and because she was safe as well.
And how did your dad change at all in prison? Do you think that had any effect on him at all?
If anything, I think the time he spent in prison exacerbated his personality, the way he already was, that sort of essence of kind of danger that he had, and the aggression that he had. He could be incredibly charming. You know, he could be really chatty and friendly. He was very attractive, and, you know, he had a way with the ladies, kind of thing. But there was always this air of danger about him, and you never knew when he was just going to suddenly snap and lose his temper, and then he'd become really aggressive. So he was, to me and to my brothers as well, quite a frightening character.
I mean, that must be... I think it's difficult when you grow up with violence in your family, how you then make relationships. And obviously, you know, it's quite hard, isn't it, to trust men and to be, you know, comfortable in their company, do you think?
Well, it has taken me a long time to trust. I have a failed marriage behind me. I've had relationships that haven't always worked out because I haven't been able to trust. And I think I've been known to have quite a fiery temper myself as well sometimes. And I've had to learn to control my anger. And, you know, from a very early age, realise that reacting in kind of an exaggerated or sort of ferocious way is not the way to behave. Even though I witnessed that sort of behaviour, I had to learn that this isn't actually the normal way to behave. But I feel that I've got to a point in my life now where I have grown up. Obviously, I'm 47, but it's kind of the first time in my life where I can say to myself, "Yeah, you're actually okay. You're steady. You're stable. You're in a good relationship." And I feel like I'm at a safe place in my life now.
I'm just going to do another travel update, and then we're going to come back to Samantha to chat some more about the book, but also about Cambridge in general around the 70s. And I'm sure you'll agree, it is fascinating stuff. So thanks, Sam, and please just stay with us. Samantha Greenwood is my guest today, and she's in the studio at Cambridge 105 talking about her book Ashes on Snow, and it's about her experience of growing up in the 1970s. We've talked a little bit about the history, which is, I mean, you couldn't make it up. I mean, no wonder you've written a book about it. It's incredible, really, what you kind of went through as a child. And we were talking about the fact your dad murdered your mum's lover, and he did go to prison for it. But let's just talk about the man that was murdered for a second. So, Samantha, you obviously lived with him. You knew him. How did you feel about his death?
Obviously, I was quite young at the time, but I do remember feeling upset about it. Because this man had taken me in and taken me and my mum in and treated me as if I was his own daughter. And he'd always been such a gentle person. The time that we spent living with him, he used to spend time trying to teach me. I can remember quite clearly him. He was very much into yoga and things related to India. And I can remember sitting, sort of doing the lotus position on the living room floor, and him trying to encourage me to meditate and teach me to say om, and even getting me to sort of stand on my head because it was meant to help sort of clear thought processes. And he was just an interesting, unusual man. And I knew that my mum definitely loved him. And he was loving towards me. He had a daughter of his own as well. And although she didn't live with us, she used to come and stay and spend time with us as well. So I just have vivid memories of him being quite a gentle person who was always very caring and considerate, and it was a real contrast to my real dad.
So, yeah, I mean, you obviously had to deal with death at a very young age, and, you know, for it to happen in quite a brutal way, by someone you know, that's a huge experience that very few people really have. I mean, I'm amazed you stay so sane.
I'm sure there are some people that will probably say, "Well, she's not sane."
But what made you want to write the book? I mean, obviously you want to get it out there. You have to.
It's kind of my family background is something I've talked about with friends, and they've always sort of looked really disbelieving and said, "Oh my God, I can't believe it. You should write about that, or, you know, tell us more. Or that would make a really good book." And I used to think, nobody would want to read that. It's all, you know, it's miserable and it's horrible and it's seedy. And then I just think, well, it's been really cathartic for me to write about it. And initially I did intend to just put it down, just write down what I was thinking and feeling, and I wasn't going to do anything with it. And the more I wrote, the more I had to look at things from other people's perspective. It made me consider the people in my book. Why did they do what they were doing at the time, and why did they behave like that? And then I started to think about other people that were probably in the same sort of situation, or other young women or young men that grew up in backgrounds like that, who are still muddling their way through it and trying to come out the other end and feel like, you know, there is positivity, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and your life doesn't have to be this and nothing else. You can take charge of your life. It doesn't have to be on a grand scale, but to just, you know, kind of steer your life in the direction that you want it to go in, mm-hmm. and not try to bury your past or bury the negativity that happened in your past, but confront it. And I almost believe it's a case of you have to own what happened, and you have to kind of take control yourself. And if you can accept what happened, and for me it was writing about it, then it's almost like you're, I suppose it's really kind of cheesy or cliche to say you're the master of your own destiny then.
I think it's quite interesting because obviously when you were researching the 70s in general around Cambridge, you did find some quite interesting statistics, didn't you? I mean, it wasn't necessarily an isolated incident what happened to you. There was a lot of crime around.
Well, no, not at all. And that was a surprising thing. I intended that it would just be about my family and my background and what I'd experienced, and it was only as I was researching I came across so many other documents and things that kind of related to events that were happening in my family, and then I found these statistics saying just how awful it was at that time in Cambridge, how much violence there was, and what, you know, that there was, it was in the midst of this real crime wave at that time.
It's interesting because obviously we're a similar age, and I grew up in Cambridge and around that sort of time, and I really remember a lot of homeless people, and I think that they were really treated quite badly, and I also remember schools. I mean, I went to a state school. It was probably quite rough at the time, but I think a lot of the schools were, and there were certain schools that had bad reputations. And there were definitely notorious people around that you knew to avoid. And often fights were organised. There would be fights between schools. You'd meet up in Cambridge and it would all kick off, as we used to say. There was definitely a rave scene. There was a big, you know, musical drug influence. I think that people are surprised. They think of Cambridge as a university city. They think of Cambridge is, you know, obviously where people go to study, and there is that side of it, obviously. And I mean, Cambridge today is very different because it's got the businesses and, you know, it's sort of more silicon, you know, but when we grew up in Cambridge, it was a very different story. I think it was, if you weren't necessarily at the university or a student, when you lived in Cambridge and you were local and from Cambridge, I saw lots of fights. I saw, you know, it was quite a common thing.
Well, the same here. I can remember I went to Netherhall School, and I can remember there being real rivalry with Coleridge, and there'd be an arranged meeting where we'd all sort of congregate over at Cherry Hinton Hall, and there'd be gangs from Coleridge School coming to clash with gangs from Netherhall. And I can remember a particular instance I write about where one of the girls from my school is carted by her arms and legs to the public toilets to have her head flushed down the loo, simply because she'd been dating a boy from Coleridge, and apparently another girl seemed to think that he was her boyfriend, and it escalated to the point where there was this kind of gang rivalry going on. And that was just one incident. I know it was the kind of thing that happened on a regular basis, these clashes.
Yeah, I definitely witnessed quite a lot of that growing up. And I think people are surprised, people that live in Cambridge now, they're surprised by that. I mean, your statistics say that Cambridge was actually more violent than Glasgow at that time. It's really surprising, isn't it?
Well, like I say, I came across that purely by coincidence. But when I read it, I mean, it seems surprising now. But when I look back to what was happening at the time, especially from my point of view and what was happening in my family, it doesn't surprise me. If I look at it from the perspective of where I was at that time in history, my life was horrible. My childhood was horrible. The background I was living in was awful. And reading those statistics just reflects what I was living through.
And I think the police, there perhaps wasn't the police around, or they were definitely targeted, weren't they? I mean, it wasn't necessarily a safe job in Cambridge to be a policeman. Or I mean, you said your uncles were involved in burglaries. There was a big crime rate, wasn't there?
Yes, there definitely was. And I don't know whether the police weren't as well equipped to deal with it at that time. I mean, now they're equipped with things like CS spray to deal with that kind of violence or aggression that's shown towards them. And I suppose it just goes to show how much, you know, time has moved on and how better equipped they are now.
I mean, it's no. I mean, my children grow up in Cambridge now, and I think they're fine. They can go to Cambridge on a weekend, or you know, you don't even think about it now. I wouldn't think about it now walking around the streets of Cambridge. But certainly, when I was growing up, it was definitely a part of life. And it's your book. We need a publisher, don't we? And we need an agent. Is that right, Sam?
Yes, that's correct. And I would be more than happy to hear from any potential agent or publisher if they were to be interested in my book.
So, I mean, if you want to get in touch with Samantha, then you can do so through Cambridge 105. Our website is cambridge105.co.uk, and Sam's, this interview will be available as well as a podcast, so look out for that. And Sam will be delighted if anyone out there can help with getting this book out, and we want to see it in the shops and we want to buy it because it's a fascinating story. And it's really, yeah, go on.
It is available at the moment. You can buy it as an ebook or as a paperback, but only from Amazon for the time being.
Brilliant. Okay, so tell us again the title and your author's name.
So it's Ash on Snow, An Alternative Childhood, and it's Samantha Greenwood.
Okay, so it's available on Amazon, and you must feel very proud when you see that.
I am. I'm chuffed to bits. And it was really lovely to see there was an article in the Evening News and it said, author of Ash on Snow. And I just thought, yay, that's me.
Good for you. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I wish you so much luck with it. Thank you, Samantha.